Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, and I'm in a hurry. No long introduction, because I think the interview I did with Randy Fortenberry in late May at his Hulbert Hall office on the Washington State University's Pullman campus speaks for itself. This is episode 79, and I'm calling it Giddy Up, a Ride with Randy Fortenberry, Ag Economist. Fortenberry holds the Thomas B. Mick Chair in Agricultural Economics at the university, an endowment created by the Washington Grain Commission and funded through grower assessments. The chair honors the former CEO of the Grain Commission. Fortenberry, who received his PhD from the University of Illinois, is no slow talker. Asking him a question is like opening up the chute in a bull riding competition. He's out and bucking. Needless to say, this is going to be a two-parter, and I'm ashamed to admit I killed some of my babies. That's writing talk for authors deleting portions of a book or article, yes, even a podcast, that they once considered off-limits. Grrr. Fortenberry speaks at many grower events and appeared at the Washington Grain Commission's May meeting, which I reference. Recently, he has been sporting a distinctive horseshoe mustache, which extends well past the sides of his mouth and makes him look like a cowboy. Which goes to my first question. Randy, a very important question as we start off this interview. What happened to the mustache?
It's summer. I lose it in the summer.
All right.
When you predict like I do, you want to change your look often.
Now, you recently returned from a conference in Chicago that included a lot of commodity folks. What was the consensus among the experts there about how the wheat industry will fare in the year ahead?
People were generally optimistic that we're going to have an improved year relative to last year. Nothing like 2012, but prices a bit higher than last year, maybe a more favorable export picture. All that, though, was sort of predicated on not losing market share based on political events. But as long as we can maintain the kind of export opportunities that people are seeing right now, there's an expectation for some price improvement next year.
Price improvement. What are we speaking of? Are we speaking of a dime? 25
No, cents? We're probably talking about maybe 75 cents to a dollar on average. And it could get better than that if we have some production issues somewhere globally or even in the U.S.
You spend a great deal of time poring over the USDA data, including the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate, called WASDE. How accurate do you think USDA numbers are over the long haul?
Well, there's always a lot of error, especially in the forecast numbers. So, for example, in May, they have already forecast the price for the 2018-19 marketing year for wheat. So there's going to be some errors, but they're not systematically wrong. In other words, there's not a consistent bias that I find over periods of time. So I think their forecasts are generally pretty good given the data available to them at the time. Some are better than others. So, for example, I think acreage numbers tend to be better than, let's say, export numbers as you go through the marketing year several times. If you go back, for example, for wheat, and you look at the forecast price range they have for the marketing year, so the marketing year is June 1st through May 31st, so almost halfway through it, most of the time, the final price we receive is actually in the range that they are predicting back in October. So they're not giving a specific price, but they do have a pretty good handle on where the price is going to end up in terms of the range, which means when you're at the top end of the range, that might be a sales opportunity. When you're at the bottom end, it might be a time for some patience.
I have a farmer who sends me his marketing guru's newsletter. And this individual seems to believe that USDA really moves the market negatively toward farmers. And this particular farmer that I deal with, he feels like there's some chicanery involved.
Well, I don't agree with that. There are times when new information does move the market in a negative direction. There's times when new information moves it positively. So I don't think there's a consistent bias against moving prices lower every time new USDA information comes out. Regardless of whether it's USDA or somebody else, when information changes significantly, the price is going to respond. And so we do see a surprise, for example, in a WASDE report where the price responds. But the same thing happens with other kinds of information. When the 6 to 10 day weather forecast changes in July, when corn is pollinating, if there's a very significant change in either expected moisture or expected average temperature for the next 6 to 10 days, the corn market reacts quite dramatically to that change in that information. If we have some sort of a catastrophic event like the Chernobyl event in the late 80s, or the invasion, the first invasion, the Desert Storm, the first invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, commodity prices respond very aggressively. So it's not just USDA that's driving the price. It is true, for example, this year, we became less and less optimistic about how much wheat we're going to export. That had a negative price impact, and USDA was lowering their export projection, but that doesn't mean they did that intentionally or that that's always the situation.
In this day and age, when there are lots of estimates from private companies and university types like yourself, will there ever be a time when USDA data collection is retired?
Possibly. In fact, some reports have been retired. And one of the things that they've talked about getting rid of in the last couple of years are those crop progress reports that I actually used to do some yield projections. But they have talked about whether or not that makes sense. A lot of that tends to be budget driven more than the private sector can take this over. There have been experiments since the 70s where USDA would drop a report or change the frequency of a report, and the market would market traders would react negatively and say the private sector isn't providing us that information. One of the arguments, two of the arguments, I guess, in favor of USDA, one of them is their data set tends to be more comprehensive than any individual private analyst can manage. So the idea is they at least provide a benchmark against which analysts provide their own analysis. A lot of what you'll see from a private analyst is, here's why I think we're going to deviate from the USDA number. So they're starting with the USDA number and then talking about why they think that might be inaccurate in one direction or the other. Without that baseline, you would have a lot of private analysts that are 2- and 3- and 4-person shops that aren't talking to farmers globally, aren't collecting satellite information, aren't talking to large merchandisers. Basically, they would be seat-of-the-pants guesses with no benchmark against which to measure their value. So even if we got to the point where USDA wasn't moving the market, it might still be providing a benchmark whereby we hold private analysts accountable for whatever numbers they project. If you're a private analyst, let's say a private analyst who's also a trader, I'm not saying people would, but they would have an incentive to shade their numbers in favor of their market position, whereas USDA has no market position.
Thank you. That makes sense. At the recent WGC meeting, you said the USDA's 10-year look into the future is wrong as hell. Explain what you mean.
Well, the reason it's wrong is because nobody can anticipate that far out. The reason I say it makes a pretty good baseline is what they're assuming on the production side is no production disruption. So they're giving us a most optimistic production expectation, which is the most pessimistic price expectation. So I'm saying we can look at that and say, okay, as we move out in the next 5, 6, or 7 years, this is kind of the worst case scenario for price. If something happens on the production side or there's a shock in demand, prices can actually improve. But if I can sort of make it on these prices, then I'm probably going to be able to survive, because those are probably going to be the worst prices I see as I look out 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 years.
And it gives farmers a benchmark of where they want to market their wheat.
Right, right. So this is sort of, again, the worst case scenarios. They're doing their long-term planning, making investment decisions. Can I make it out of those long-term price projections? Because if I can, I'm probably going to be fine. But if it becomes really dicey, then I need to recognize there is the possibility that with an excellent production environment and no big change in demand, those will be the prices I end up experiencing.
What do the WASDE numbers released in May reveal about marketing the upcoming wheat crop?
I don't know if they gave us a lot of information. It was our very first look at what the 2018-19 marketing year is going to look like, so the harvest for this coming year and then going forward. In May and June, those numbers, the production numbers, aren't based on any actual survey of the crop itself. So they have the planting intentions report, which came out March 29th. That's what farmers then said they thought they might plant. But we don't really know if those acres got planted or not. For example, the spring wheat acres, in my opinion, were probably overstated given the weather conditions that North Dakota, parts of Montana, maybe South Dakota faced. And they're using trend yields, so they haven't accounted for any kind of weather problems we may or may not have had this year. So the May and June reports don't tell me a lot. It's really later in the year where I start to pay attention to those. The one thing that it might have helped us with is sort of understanding where they think we might have export market opportunities in the coming year. But I'm not sure it gave me price targets or marketing decisions that I wasn't already thinking about just because of that May WASDE. May and June are kind of the least informative, in my opinion, of the WASDE reports.
Okay, well, here's my next question. If a farmer only looked at one USDA report a year, which report would you suggest him or her to pick?
So let me make sure I understand the question, because I could take that one of two ways. If I picked a single report that I was going to follow through a year, and I was a wheat farmer, probably the most important thing from maybe October through April is the weekly export pace. Are we on task to match USDA's export projection? If we're not, that's a price negative situation. If we are, I expect prices to be relatively stable. If we're beating it, I expect some price improvement. If you're asking me, I'm only going to look at one report once a year, don't look at any of them, because none of them give you that perfect snapshot. It's more about their change over time. How are we reevaluating what the market is telling us and what kind of market conditions are than that one snapshot?
And what about for yourself in the work you do? What's the USDA report that you find most valuable in your line of work?
It changes depending on the time of year. So July, August, September, I'm paying a lot of attention to WASDE, telling me something about what the yields really were, what were the actual acres that went into the current harvest. And then I can think about whether when I look at the futures market, it's telling me hold some of that inventory and sell it later, or go ahead and sell it now. When I get to October, then I'm, like I would suggest to a producer, I'm watching those weekly export reports for wheat especially. Are we exporting on a pace that's going to suggest we will or will not meet USDA's final crop year estimate? And the reason is, in my opinion, for wheat anyway, that becomes on the demand side a more important driver. We don't see a lot of change in domestic food use, the amount we're going to use for seed or that we did use for seed. This residual number that's calculated with feed, that number can change a lot because it's really an accounting balancing number. It doesn't mean very much. So the one number I really care about is the export number. So then those reports matter. Then when we start to get to the spring, I do start looking at, okay, what are our planted acres likely to be for what were they for winter wheat? Were they likely to be for spring wheat? And what does that tell me about the next year's crop? And then beginning in April, I actually watch those crop progress reports and start to get my expectation about the upcoming harvest based on the information in those reports. So it varies by season.
I'm going to just throw in a question here. Why is it that Northwest prices are always higher than Midwest prices?
There's a couple of reasons. One is in the Northwest, we're pricing a higher quality wheat product. So soft white wheat versus in the Midwest, soft red winter wheat is really what's grown in the Illinois, southern Wisconsin, southern Minnesota area. That's the lowest price wheat generally. Sometimes the hard red winter wheat will be at a discount if there's excess protein in the market. The other thing is we're much closer to our terminal market, so there's less transportation to get to our consumer. When we're at Portland, all we have to do now is go to Tokyo. When we're in the Midwest, we still have to get down to the Gulf, because wheat is still an export commodity, or we have to get into Mexico, or we have to get to the West Coast in order to get on a vessel to export to whoever our consumer happens to be.
So wheat is a global commodity with prices that depend on world supply and demand. And yet, it often appears the U.S. has a separate market in price. Explain how that works.
It looks like it does, but it really doesn't. And so what's hidden in there are things like exchange rate changes. So if we see a large change in the value of the Japanese yen relative to the U.S. dollar, then the price in Tokyo and the price in the U.S. are going to change based on the cost of converting those currencies. Transportation costs matter a lot. Places that have a relative excess supply, so they produce more than they consume and have to ship it out, tend to have lower prices than places with a relative excess demand. And when you account for all of those changes for the various locations you might be comparing, so Tokyo or Seoul compared to Portland, those prices really aren't that different. And what influences one will tend to influence the other one. But since these other things are changing at the same time, like exchange rates, then you might not get a one-for-one change in those two prices because a third determinant is also moving at the same time. So they really aren't separate, but they can look like it because of the complication of everything that's feeding in to that individual price at that specific location.
So let's take Russia, for instance. Russia always seems to have lower prices. Is that because they don't have storage and they need to get rid of it immediately?
Well, historically, now this is changing. They've had a much lower quality wheat. In fact, the parts of the market that they've taken away from us is really the Middle East and North Africa, where people only care about price. They don't really care much about quality. So they've gone into these very low price markets where people only want to worry about how much they're paying. And that's where we've lost some market share to Russia. So it's about a lower quality product. Now, that's changing. And as they continue to improve both the genetics and the infrastructure that they use to get to the Black Sea, they will start to compete in higher quality markets. But historically, it's just been that they're just competing on price and delivering the lowest quality wheat into the world market.
So does that mean we ain't seen nothing yet?
It means we may not have seen anything yet. Yeah, it could. And it's not just Russia. The Ukraine also. The corollary is 20 years ago when we were losing market share to South America for soybeans, everybody focused on Brazil. But it really was Brazil and Argentina together. So Brazil was the bigger producer, but the two of them together really were moving in the same direction. And Ukraine and Russia are very similar that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference how much wheat the U.S. is producing?
Well, it does for a couple of reasons. One, the larger your world market share, the more influence you have on the price. And what that means is if we had a production disaster, our producers would see higher prices than they would see if we were such a small part of the world market that we didn't matter. So now you have a drought or a hail event or some other disaster that wipes out part of the wheat crop, and the domestic price doesn't really respond because we're such a small player in the market. So in terms of international price influence, it matters. It also matters in terms of being a reliable supplier. If you're a very small producer and the amount of product you can bring to the market varies a lot from year to year, people are not going to look at you as their primary supplier. They're going to come to you when they might have a shortfall, but you're not the player that they're looking to for their initial purchase. And you want to be that person too.
And when are we going to meet that threshold?
Well, we are an important supplier now. Whether we become less dominant and we run into that problem is a function of a couple of things. Right now, a lot of it is political. If we actually sacrifice a significant part of our agricultural markets or our treatment in international markets in terms of favorable trade treatment to satisfy some other objective for some other sector, then that can happen sooner than later. If we slowly erode our market share to the point where we're not influencing price and we're not a dominant supplier, that happens over a longer period of time. I don't see that as a major risk. Even though wheat acres have been going down dramatically, you know, this year could be an exception, last year was an exception, we still haven't seen the same kind of reduction in overall production. So we're still looked to as a quality supplier and a reliable supplier. So right now the risk is political in terms of that happening.
We're not a residual supplier at this point. We're not a market of last resort.
Not for quality wheat products, no.
The USDA expects that the 2018 wheat crop is going to be the third smallest in the last 20 years, and you believe it may be even smaller than that. Which crops are benefiting from wheat's decline?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is, if we talk about a longer-term trend of reducing wheat acres, the acres that have been replaced have really been corn and soybean acres, especially in the North Dakota, South Dakota area. But we've also seen a lot of wheat acres replaced by pulses in Montana and western North Dakota. So if you're just talking about production, acres going into production as being the beneficiary, it's really those crops. In terms of talking about this year's crop being smaller than USDA's projection, I'm not sure anybody really benefits except to the extent that if we get slightly higher wheat prices than we otherwise would have had with USDA's production estimate, some of the other grain crops might also benefit in terms of higher prices to the extent that those prices are interrelated.
Well, how much is wheat's decline based on the fact that it's not a GMO?
You mean in terms of acres?
Right.
So that's a really good question. That's a part of it. But really, I've argued for a long time, it goes all the way back to the 1996 Farm Bill when prices were very low for all commodities, but we were offering a guaranteed price, the loan rate program at that time, for soybeans that had a higher return over production costs compared to wheat. And so people in the Dakota started thinking, well, maybe I can substitute away from wheat and go into this other crop even though I don't have a lot of experience with it. Where the GMO came in, though, is Now I have a Roundup ready soybean crop. I'm going to rotate it with corn. So if I can start stacking traits in corn and get a really narrow production window so I don't have to worry about a frost event, and I may not be able to plant as early as I would, let's say, in southern Illinois, but I can get planted on time. Genetics helps us develop varieties to grow in those new environments, and wheat doesn't do that because we don't do GMO wheat. So it could have helped it, but it wasn't the only thing that drove that substitution of acres. Public policy had something to do with it as well.
It wasn't until about 4 years ago that the U.S. was the largest wheat exporter in the world. Then Canada surpassed us, and now Russia appears to be in the driver's seat. Does it matter which country is the world's number one exporter?
Yeah, so going back to the other statement, you know, the larger your market share, the more influence you have on price. So to that extent, it matters some. But the thing is, wheat isn't like corn. So for corn, which is corn is corn is corn, except South Africa's white corn, which is a little bit different. But number two, yellow corn is traded everywhere. That's what they grow in the Ukraine. That's what we grow. That's what Brazil grows. That's what Argentina grows. All going to the same market. For wheat, because we have all these different classes with all different demand centers, just being the largest exporter of wheat may not mean much if, in Russia's case, for example, it continues to be relatively low-quality, low-priced wheat. We are the largest exporter of soft white wheat to a very strong demand center. And so what matters more with wheat is identifying your market potential, satisfying that market, and not worrying as much maybe about your overall portfolio size versus concentrating on those products where you have a quality premium and a really solid customer base. Now, because all wheat prices are linked, even those prices for the quality product will be somewhat affected by, let's say, a Russia dominating export markets. And we do face the risk that they improve the quality of their product and they start to compete with some of these other markets where we still dominate.
And that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing again and again that Russian wheat is getting better.
It is getting better. And so is Ukrainian wheat. Again, it's the whole Black Sea. It's not just Russia where we face that quality competition as we move forward.
In terms of impacts to the industry over the last 20 years, where would you place Russia's wheat market? Well, let's say Russia and Ukraine's wheat market expansion.
Well, it's had a huge impact on relatively lower prices over the last 3 or 4 years compared to, let's say, 2012, where we had $9 soft white wheat prices at harvest. But it's not just them. It's also that nobody's had really a production problem. So they've been expanding. They've been taking market share in the export market, growing. But at the same time, nobody else has had a problem. So everybody has been aggressively moving product into the export market, who's a large exporter. And so if we had had, let's say, a crop disaster in Australia, then some of the Russian impact would have been offset with a lower supply from a different dominant producer and exporter. So they've had an impact. They do help explain why prices are where they are, but it's not just them alone. It's been this situation where for 3 or 4 years, nobody's really had a production problem.
And what about consumption? Where is consumption?
So this is, again, one of those lower baseline numbers the USDA has. So consumption grows, but sort of at its 15-year trend. So it just sort of consistently grows a little bit over time as we go forward.
Is this a function of population or is
it's
this
a function of population growth and growth in expected incomes, which changes people's diet. So what could change? Well, some sort of a health notice, either positive or negative, about wheat or whole grains or something like that could change the overall demand center. A new use, a new food product is developed and wheat somehow is an important ingredient, or wheat is substituted for some other ingredient in a current staple food. All of those things can change the consumption patterns, which also can affect price and market share to the extent that variety matters in these new uses.
Now, corn and soybean have lots of uses besides just as feed. Does it surprise you that wheat doesn't have other uses?
Wheat does have some. We feed wheat in parts of the world. And in fact, when we had 2012 prices at $9 a bushel, we actually were feeding quite a bit of that wheat because corn was so expensive that dairy producers on the West Coast and even in southern Idaho were mixing wheat into their feed ration. So wheat does have some other uses. What's interesting is corn and soybeans have a lot of different uses, like you said, industrial applications, biofuels, feed, in the case of soybeans, food, soybean oil.
Ink for newspapers.
Yeah. Wheat does, but it's by variety, right? So where we send soft red winter wheat is not where we send white wheat. Those are very different demand centers. So again, it's not like wheat is wheat, even though corn is corn. So we look at a single corn grain, and we can move it to any one of these areas. It could go to an ethanol plant. It could go to a dairy to be fed. It could be processed for oil, right? When we look at wheat, it's not like that. Each one of those wheat kernels, depending on variety, has a different demand center that it's going to help satisfy.
I don't know about you, but I've listened to this interview more than once and gotten more out of it each time. Talk about drinking from a fire hose. And there's more ahead in Giddy Up, a ride with Randy Fortenberry, Ag Economist Part 2, in which I use the idiomatic phrase, the catbird seat, to ask Fortenberry if that's the lucky place soft white wheat resides. If you're still listening, harvest is coming up and thousands of farmers, their families, and employees will be driving various pieces of farm equipment around the region. Listening to this podcast while at the wheel of a vehicle is one of life's few opportunities to truly multitask. There are hours of education about our wonderful wheat industry in the Wheat All About It archive on the WGC website at wagrains.org. I'm urging all of you who have mastered this podcast to reach out to your universe of friends and teach them how to download, listen, and learn. And drive, too. Please join me again next week for another semester full of education in a little more than 20 minutes in episode 80 of Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us to this head. Through a history of starvation in times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma, when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.